Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have partially an Italian program.
Yeah, mostly, actually.
Mostly Italian, with a little gold vodka thrown in.
There you go. Well, you have to wait to find out what that means. So be sure to hang around till the end. It's a very interesting story.
Well, to start with, I mean, talk about a story. We always love having Lydia Bastianich on, and she's just released her third children's book. And she's an amazing person. And I know our grandchildren adore these books.
And this one's very unusual in that it's a single subject, mostly. It's mostly about eggs.
Eggs. Peter and I join the hordes of people on how many continents, I'm not even quite sure yet, because now you're also in South America, Lydia Bastianich, as fans of yours, and everybody secretly just loves you as though you're related to them. How did this all happen? It just snowballed, didn't it, your celebrity?
You know, I'm kind of, when I look back at it, I'm surprised too. It's been more than 40 years that I do, you know, I cook, have restaurants and books and television, and somehow it just evolved. One opportunity after another presented. I was very careful about taking each opportunity, making sure that I can do justice to it. And then I took it and I ran. And, you know, as you can see, one of my latest is children's cookbooks. And this is my third one. You know, Lydia's an exciting farm adventure. So it's, you know, again, about food, sharing with children and bringing children really to the source of food and recipes to make food.
Well, we've interviewed you about each one of these books. This is the third children's book. As I said, you go from strength to strength. The motivation for this book, I thought that you mentioned it before lunch, that it's not just your own grandchildren, but you wanted something for their children as well, because they're pretty grown up now, aren't they? Your grandchildren.
Yes, and I have five grandchildren, and now they range from 12 to 18. But when they were small, they would pile up in bed with me, and it was, Nona, tell us a story when you were a little girl. And when I was a little girl, it was a great courtyard with my grandma and all the courtyard animals, chickens, ducks, pigs, rabbits, and, of course, the vegetables that we grew around it. So it was an idyllic setting of, you know, feeding oneself from the earth. And so, you know, now they're grown up. They don't want to listen to my little stories anymore. So I said, you know, I'm going to put this down. They're hopefully going to have children. And it's going to be for my great-grandchildren and for other children out there that I can share maybe and get them closer to the source of food.
Well, now, our grandchildren have the other two books, and they will have this one as well. Surprised how much they love these books, because it's almost an alien universe anymore, having chickens in a courtyard. And how did your grandchildren react to these stories when they were young and you were telling them?
Well, they had the added benefit of actually kind of going back to Italy with me and my husband and sort of enjoying some of these real settings, because, you know, there are little towns in Italy that chickens still roam, and you know, the eggs are still kind of warm and used every day to make pasta. So I think that my children had that extra of really being knowing the setting as well as the stories. But you know, now ever more this urban kind of society, it's difficult to get out there, and I think that it's important for children to understand. And hopefully, although, you know what, Anne, I feel ever better and more confident for the interest that is in food, in the health that food can provide for us, our concern about the environment and seasonality and locality. All of this is coming ever more evident with the chefs, so the word is spreading.
Tell us particularly about this Lydia's Exciting, EGG, Sighting Farm Adventure. You have a number of stories wrapped up into this one. Tell us just a little bit about them, and then let's talk about the recipes and how kids can participate.
It begins with the story of actually me being in the little courtyard and how I was in charge with my little basket of collecting the nice, still warm eggs that the chick, my grandmother's chickens laid. And grandma would know exactly when the chicken would clock, clock, and she would send me up, and then we would come down and bake together or make pasta together. And then the story continues about us with my grandchildren doing, going to the farm. So, the story takes them to the farm, getting to see the chickens, how a real healthy way for chicken and for animals is to roam the terrain, to eat the grasshoppers and the worms that are around. And that really gives them natural nourishment and makes the eggs and the meat real and better. Getting to know the chickens, getting to know the farmer that takes the time to raise this chicken properly. And then the finale is, of course, going back home and making a meal with all of these eggs. And in the book itself, there's about 8 recipes that contain eggs that are doable, and hoping that, you know, once this book is read to children, that it is not closed and put away, but that this book kind of pulls everybody into the kitchen. Now let's cook.
One of the most standout features of your books are these illustrations, and it's the same illustrator for all 3 books, I think. And I mean, knowing the people that the illustrations are based on, I mean, they're absolutely amazing. I'm looking at your son, Joe.
Yes, the characters are all real. It's my family with the real names, my grandchildren, grandma's in there. The illustrator was quite local. I mean, the illustrations are quite lookalike, real, us real. So if you have been watching us on television, you will recognize us. It's the illustration is in the style of the books that I remember as being a child. Very romantic, very soft. I think she did a great job, the illustrator. And her name is Renee Grafe.
Ultimately, this is so far removed from how every child goes through a day in a city. I'm still amazed that our grandchildren are so enthralled with these stories. What do you think is the secret of enticing these children to read these stories?
I think, you know, children realize when things are really relevant and when things are real. And, you know, this particular story being my story, my growing up, you know, it's kind of a little biography, if you will, simplistically through food, as I grew up with food and what generated or created the passion in me about food, and ultimately the appreciation. But you know, and it's also in today's world, I think that we need to really be very cognizant of what we eat and how we grow it and how are we gonna feed our future generations. So I think that all wrapped in this children's story really can, it's a story that goes up to adulthood and could be shared with the children. And so children just want, they know when it's real. They know when the story is really meaningful.
Well, growing up with you, I mean, I'm sure they're exposed to really good, healthy food. Could I just pause a minute, because we haven't talked to you since we were at your Friuli property or Sode. I thought that was absolutely marvelous. Just give our listeners a few details about how they could find out about Orsone.
Well, our property, Orsone and the Bastianich Winery, is in Friuli Venezia Giulia. Italy has 20 regions, and Friuli Venezia Giulia is in the northeast corner of Italy. So it borders to the north with Austria, to the east with Slovenia, and it's on the Adriatic Sea to the south. It is, the property itself is near the city, the little city of Cividale del Friuli, which is about an hour north of Venice. So if you want to find out more, really look at orsone.com or bastianich.com. It will take you to the site, and ultimately you have all the information there.
I would be remiss if I didn't say, your son Joe, who's a really down-to-earth guy here in the States, is like, he's on another planet in Italy. He's so popular. What's going on there?
Yes, I'm glad, because you were there recently, and you stayed at Orsone at our winery. We have five little rooms and a restaurant, so it's a really cozy place. And you have kind of noticed the popularity of Joe in Italy. Well, let me tell you, he's a rock star in Italy. And I think it all came about because he is an Italian American and he's born in America. So, but he feels very Italian. So the two combinations, and I think what really is very cute is, you know, the way he speaks Italian, every once in a while he kind of mixes up a word, and the Italians just love it. They make fun of him, and they love him. So, you know, I'm ever so grateful that here my child, being born in America, is so accepted in Italian.
I want to close with a thought. Think about this one. Comment on it if you like. Or we'll just wait and see if it happens. But I forecast that Lydia's exciting farm adventure might spell the end of the Ed McMuffin.
I don't know about the end, you know, but certainly we'll give it a run for the money. We hope.
You're just amazing, Lydia. Thank you so much for talking to us.
And we'll be back on an Italian theme in Rome right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. Now, some people are snippy about social media. I happen to like it a lot, particularly Twitter. And that's how I met this remarkable woman, Elizabeth Minchilli, and learned about her activities in Italy, and particularly about what we're going to discuss shortly, her book called Eating Rome. I think that I met Elizabeth Minchilli on Twitter, but I'm not altogether sure. But as far as I'm concerned, anybody endorsed by Frank Bruni is worth my talking to and worth paying attention to. Welcome, Elizabeth, to On the Menu, and congratulations on this new book.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me here. I'm excited to talk about it and meet you.
Well, you have so much going on in your life. You have a blog, you have apps. You do tours of various parts of Italy. You are based in Rome.
I am.
Yes, and you have a background of living in Italy. This latest book is called Eating Rome, Living the Good Life in the Eternal City. And this is a book that anybody coming to visit Rome for the first time, or even as we do repeatedly, I've learned things from your books. You have tips on things that I had never even considered.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, I never thought, of course, I've never tried to bargain at an open market for fruits and vegetables, but at the same time, I never thought it was something that wasn't done until you told me. And it's true with how much bread you should eat when you get it on your plate, or what about eating on the street?
There's a lot of things that one can, I think, get out of the book. I like to think of the book as not just a guidebook, though, for coming to Rome. I think there's a lot in it for people who aren't even coming here, and the way that it was structured is that we put a lot into it. There's a big takeaway for everybody, and there's lots of recipes and there's narrative. So I hope everybody, you know, is able to get something out of it, even if they're not coming to Rome.
Yeah, and you did a smashing good job on photography, which is a new venture for you, isn't it?
When I started the blog, I realized that I was going to, and that was, I started the blog in 2010. And up until that point, I had worked on my books with professional photographers because I did big coffee table books, you know, the kind of books, you know, that are on Italian villas and restoring country homes. And I always worked with quite talented photographers. But when I got to my blog, I realized that, well, there really wasn't the budget to hire photographers anymore. So I had to learn on the job. And that's been one of the most satisfying and rewarding things is becoming a better photographer.
How did you go from being an art historian graduate student to an expat food writer living in Rome?
Well, of course, the story has to do with meeting a guy.
Yeah, doesn't it always?
I mean, the reason I'm here is because I met my husband, Domenico, when I was just finishing my dissertation. And within a year of meeting him, I was living in Florence, I had an Italian husband, I had an Italian baby, I had an Italian dog, and I found myself with a new career because a friend of mine had just launched a magazine in the States and asked if, did I want to write for her? And I said, sure, you know, why not? I'm writing anyway. I'm writing about art every day as an art historian. And so I started writing for her and I realized that this could be a career and I embraced it. And I started writing about art, but I soon found that writing about almost anything except art, I actually got paid more money. So I started venturing into other sorts of topics, and that included travel, it included design, it included, of course, food. So I've been writing about all these topics for the last 20 years or so from Rome.
Do you know, I forgot to mention to you, I did tell you that you and I have a lot in common, that I was once an art historian as well. Do you know Ruth Reichel also started out at the University of Michigan in art history? Graduate work.
She did? No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's funny.
A lot of us food professionals started out as art historians, and I think there is some sort of connection between the love of beauty and the love of food.
I heard that it was also attention to detail.
It also might have something to do with the availability of work. I
don't know if it's attention to detail, but it's attention to something good.
Well, I'm a geographer by training, and all my classmates at the University of Cambridge all went into teaching except me. So it gives you an idea there aren't a lot of other jobs for art historians. And as a result,
yes,
they finish up doing something else.
Now, tell us about this book. I mean, you have such a... How long have you been in Rome now?
I've been in Rome. Well, I lived in Rome as a child. I lived in Rome when I was 12 and 13 years old with my parents.
And your Barbie
and
dolls.
Always,
and your Barbie.
Me?
And your Barbie dolls.
And my Barbie dolls, yes. Like my suitcase full of Barbie dolls, which I wish I still had today. I bet they'd be worth something. Mm. But, so we moved to Rome in the early 70s. And I always came back with my father in the summers. And I was trying to figure out a way to get back here, I think, almost, you know, all of my adult life. And I finally came back, you know, as you mentioned, as an art historian. I was living in Florence and then stayed here. And I moved to Florence in about 27 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've been here quite a long time.
And
I am officially Roman at this point.
Well, Florence is now a totally different place from it was when I was there in school and when you lived there. I mean, as a student.
Well, Florence is a different place. Rome is a different place. But there's still, you know, there's still pockets of... there's still neighborhoods that remain the same, and certainly at different times of the year, they're different. But, you know, I still go into restaurants, and it's still the same waiters that were there from 1973. It's you know, the owners are a little bit older, but some things don't change. A lot does, but some things stay the same, which is something that is very attractive to me.
Well, how did you organize this book? This is not your usual, typical guide to Rome book.
No, the book was actually, I thank my editor a lot for helping me at St. Martin's. And it was hard to decide how to divide the book into chapters. We thought chronologically, but that didn't quite work. So in the end, we decided to take themes that were big in my life. themes that appeared again and again on my blog, themes that I had to deal with every day that had to do with food. So whether it was a chapter on coffee, a chapter on ice cream, a gelato, a chapter on pasta. And those sort of broad themes allowed me to tell stories that were both personal and stories about Rome, so, and also discuss recipes for each of these topics. So in the end, it was the thematic chapters that allowed me the widest range.
Well, some of your stories are so hilarious. I loved the one about trying to buy dog food.
I know. That was in Florence. I was expected to cook for my dog.
I tried buying cat food. That was pretty funny, too.
No, I mean, a cat, but, I was supposed to go first and buy rice and then to the butcher and buy meat and cook this thing, you know, for my dog who I couldn't believe I was going to have to spend every morning cooking his dinner.
I also like your section on breakfast, and the Italian breakfast. Busy these cafes are and the coffee bars
are. Well, yeah, no, it's funny. You know, it is just today. I was walking around a neighborhood called Pistaccio here in Rome, and a friend of mine, my friend Jillian, and I went in a coffee shop. And sure enough, you know, some American came in and they went and got their coffee and sat down at the table without paying the correct amount. And the owners just started yelling at them because they didn't know the rules. Well, the rules change. The rules are always different. And how are you supposed to know them? And it's very funny to laugh at it, except if it's happening to you.
Well, let me tell you my famous Italian morning coffee story from the very first time that I was in Rome with Anne.
Can you do abbreviated
version? I can do an abbreviated version, I guess, but Anne was still sleeping, and at that time she couldn't stir out of bed without coffee. But I also knew that coffee at Le Grand Hotel was going to be something like 30 million lira, not covered by our travel budget. So I went out looking for coffee that I could bring into the hotel.
And I thought,
I'm in good shape here. I looked across the street, and there was a coffee bar. I said, well, that's perfectly fine. So I studied from curbside what was going on, and I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out where you ordered, what you ordered, how you paid, any of those things, just like your friend was having trouble in Testaccio.
But you know what? I know what coffee shop you're talking about, and that coffee shop has a reputation for the owners being particularly mean.
Oh, really?
Well, I prowled the neighborhood. I thought bingo when I saw a sign for McDonald's in the Piazza di Indipendencia, and then I discovered that McDonald's didn't open till lunchtime, so that was no good. And I kept on going, and every shop was busy, 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 and then I found one on a side street, and using sign language.
Well, you didn't speak Italian either, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't speak a word of Italian. I explained what I wanted using sign language. There were two little empty soda bottles underneath the counter, and I pointed to those, and I wanted coffee in those, and I wanted to take them away with me.
which
is unheard of, but those two split empty bottles of tonic water went through the first 2 weeks I spent in Italy with me buying Anne morning coffee in them every single day.
And, I hope she appreciated it.
She's never said. She just laughed at me and said, "What did you think you were doing?" And I said, "I was being nice. I was getting you coffee. I should get a prize for that at the very least."
Now you have all these quirks that most people don't anticipate, and your comments are, you have like a set of rules after each of these chapters of do's and don'ts. Let's take one of them and. Listen, how about the one about the outdoor markets? What do you...
Oh, about the... Oh, not touching anything.
Yes, that's... Most people don't understand that one. That's a big no-no.
Well, the main thing that took me a long time to learn about shopping in these markets, a market that you go to repeatedly every day, is that you have to pick your vendor and stick to them. It's sort of like a marriage. You can't cheat on your vendor. If they see you cheating, they're going to take it out on you by giving you a rotten tomato the next time they see you. So it took me a while to figure that out. And that's something, you know, no Italian would explain that to you because they take it for granted. So it's something that was hard won.
It's the opposite of intuitively obvious. Intuitively obvious, if you were in a market in the United States, you would automatically go to the line that's the shortest. just like you would at the bank. And in fact, we learned, and of course you learned the same thing probably before we did, that in fact the very line you want to be in is the one that's the longest, because that means that after 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of shopping there, everybody knows this is the best place to shop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You want to follow the crowds in an Italian market.
Now, we can't remember. We think that we have eaten at that restaurant that you say is your favorite trattoria in Rome.
The one in Testaccio.
Yeah, Periti.
I think we've eaten there, but I'm not sure.
Yeah,
It's possible. I mean, the thing is, everybody's always asking me, what is my favorite restaurant in Rome? Well, my favorite restaurant is my favorite restaurant for many personal reasons. It might not be your personal favorite restaurant. It might not be my neighbor's personal favorite restaurant. A lot of it, I would say 75% of it has to do with the food. But then there's that 25% that has to do with your relationship to the people who work there, the memories you have associated with it, where it is, the weather, you know, things like that. So it's very hard to, although I write and say this is my all-time favorite restaurant in Rome, I don't want to make people think it has to be theirs as well. They might have another favorite restaurant. There's no right and wrong.
Some of your other rules are like when to eat gelato. Now, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, it took me a long time to figure out that you're supposed to eat gelato sometime in the late afternoon but before dinner, which did not make sense to me at all. But like everything, I've embraced that.
Oh, well, you're mostly at home there now.
I am.
How is this, your app, how is it different? Is it specific?
Well, my app is, you know, on the blog, I talk about restaurants and I give recipes. It's not that easy. If you're coming to Rome, you'd have to do a lot of reading through the blog to get to the restaurants. And then in my book, really, it's not an exhaustive listing of restaurants. As I said, the book is divided thematically. So some restaurants are in different chapters. They're there, and I invite people to use it as a guidebook. But then the apps are purely a restaurant guide to the different cities.
Okay, and YouTube tours.
And also they're on your phone, they're on your iPad, and you can search through them quite easily.
Now, how many of these tours and what size tours are they that you give?
I started doing tours pretty early on because people started asking me to do them. I never really thought that I would be doing food tours. I knew that I never wanted to do tours of the sites like the Roman Forum or the Sistine Chapel that seemed like going back to graduate school for me, and I didn't want to do that. But the idea of food tours was really attractive, and I love it. And I do private tours, and they're very small. They're usually just anywhere from 2 to 8 people, and they're always, you know, one family or one group of people. And I do a few tours. I do a tour around the Campo di Fiori neighborhood in the Jewish ghetto, which is one of my most popular tours. I do another tour around the Monti neighborhood where I live. I'm planning other tours in now. I've been doing research, and by research I mean eating a lot. I've been doing research on 2 new tours, one in Testaccio and one in Trastevere. And the great thing now is that my daughter is, you know, grown and moved back to Rome, and she's starting to work with me as well. And she's starting a whole new business where she has found nonne or grandmothers here in Rome, and she takes people into their houses for a cooking lesson and a dinner with a real Roman family.
With nonnes? That's not interesting.
No, it's fun. I think that it's true, all roads do lead to Rome, and most people who end up here have to eat. And so it's been very successful.
Well, that's great. Well, I hope that you have a lot of success with your book. Again, it's called Eating Rome, Living the Good Life in the Eternal City. But you keep adding to your blog, so why don't you give us the address for your blog?
I will. My blog is Elizabeth Minchilli in Rome, and that's spelled like it sounds like Minchilli. So Elizabeth Minchilli in Rome.com.
Okay, and you update that how often?
I update it my blog 3 times a week.
Oh, that's pretty good, Elizabeth. I don't know how you fit that one in.
And it's a mixture, usually, of recipes and restaurant reviews. And I've started also, the one thing that I've started this year that's very exciting and new is I'm doing videos now.
Uh-huh.
So you can follow me on YouTube as well. And
I did videos of
me cooking and other people cooking as well. And they're really fun.
Everybody wants us to add video to this audio. And I found out you can't just do that. You have to have separate things you do. But I did.
Well, you know, for me, it's just another way of keeping the whole thing interesting and keeping it growing. And also, I love doing it.
Now, you have a big event starting May 1 in Milano. And that coincides with a new venture you have. You want to tell our listeners about that? Is it really a scoop?
Sure. No, May is the Expo 2015, and that's basically the World's Fair. And this year it's in Milan, and it's going to run from May through, I think, October. And in occasion of this, I've written another app. It's called Eat Milan, and it will be, I think, pretty much the only app in English to eating in Milan. And I've been researching that for the last 6 months or so. And, of course, by researching, again, I mean eating.
Yeah.
And I've eaten in most of the restaurants in Milan at this point. And I've always gone to Milan for work, so I know the city quite well. And the app will be available through my website and on iTunes. And you can download it to your iPhone or your iPad. And it's the perfect companion to visiting the expo.
That sounds great to me. The one that I have to...
You have to come over and use it.
Well, we're planning on that. We're trying to do that at any rate. The one thing that I have never been able to find any place good to eat in Venice. And you have an app for that, too.
Oh, I've written a guide to Venice. There's great places to eat in Venice. Venice is more of a challenge because it's so purely... It's become a tourist town. Whereas Rome, you know, there's real people who live here, and even Florence... And certainly Milan. Whereas Venice, the number of Venetians, at this point, they're saying it's like 20% of the population is Venetian. So it's hard to find authentic places where locals go, but there are authentic places where some locals go and that cater to tourists. You just have to search for them.
Well, everybody used to always say da Fiore, but it's gone down the tubes. Yeah, so anyhow, well, we could go on forever. And as I said, I feel like we're kind of almost related. We have so many overlapping areas of interest.
No, I know. That's true.
But the book we're promoting right now is Eating Rome. And I wish you a great deal of success with your writing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure sounds like a book with great advice, doesn't it?
Yes.
And contrary to what people will tell you, that you can't get a bad meal in Italy, you can get very few bad meals, but Rome is a place where you might be able to. So this is good advice.
This is a good app.
This is a good book. And plus, Elizabeth's a really nice person. And if you really want somebody to show you around Rome, I can't think of a better person to do that.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we go with another old friend, Domenica Marchetti, who we've interviewed before. And believe me, I didn't think you could weave around so many different takes on a cookie as she did.
But you can.
Yeah, and she did both savory and sweet takes on biscotti, the absolute perfect Italian cookie for just about any time of the day. Anyhow, let's listen to Domenica talk about ciao biscotti. You know, Domenica Marchetti, I don't know what you're going to write about next. And here's an entire book, Ciao Biscotti. And I didn't even realize that you could have so many variations on a really basic Italian cookie.
Yes, and that's absolutely right. And I have to say that this book really does stray from tradition in that sense. I was a little bit dubious about it when I first started working on the project because, yeah, you could say that there is only one biscotto. You've got your classic biscotto made with flour and sugar and eggs and almonds and not much else. But it's a jumping off point for all kinds of variations. So I kind of let my imagination run wild and had fun with it.
We know that there are a number of different approaches, even to the basic biscotto, because my mother was obsessed with finding the perfect biscotto recipe. And so growing up, I ate a lot of them. And I don't think she ever found what she was looking for. And I don't know, it was tied to some sort of childhood experience, but I don't think she ever duplicated it.
That's so interesting. Now, I grew up in a house, you know, my mother was from Abruzzo, and she didn't actually make biscotti grow when I was growing up. She made Italian wine cookies, and she made pizzelle, or they're also known as ferratelle, which come from the Abruzzo region. So I didn't really grow up with biscotti, and I'll tell you, it took me a little while to fall in love with them. I had sort of just had the kind that come in packages or that you find at the coffee house, and I thought they were okay. But as I started researching them, I really started to warm up to them because they're really so simple at their most basic, and they serve such a great purpose, which is to dip them into a nice little glass of vin santo after dinner. It's so civilized. It's just a little bit of a sweet treat after dinner, and I really came to enjoy that little ritual working on the book. And in fact, after I was done with it and I had moved on to my next project, I kind of missed having biscotti around the house, so I have to keep baking them anyway. But yeah,
they're pretty sophisticated in, if you really think about it. The dough's a little tricky.
It can be quite sticky, but there are not any number of ways that you can actually make the dough. I mean, if you want to do it the real traditional Italian way, you do it the way you would make pasta, which is, you know, mound your dry ingredients on the on the worktop, and then you add in your wet ingredients and your nuts. But I use the mixer because that's a nice modern enjoy, and it kind of breaks up the nuts just the right amount, and it makes the dough easy to mix. It's a little bit sticky when you have to form it into the loaf,
right?
But if you've done it a couple of times, you really do quickly get the hang of it.
Well, talk about now the word itself, because we just had an interview with Ann Willen, who breaks down the secrets from La Varenne, and she breaks down the different kinds of pastry doughs, and she said biscuit is one of them, biscuit. It's one of them. But Peter always said that, and of course, biscotti is a good example, that the word itself means twice baked. And of course, her doughs aren't, you know, in this French variety.
In fact, to the best of our knowledge, he said the person who christened them biscuits probably made it up.
Oh, that's interesting. So I don't know about the French version, I have to confess, but I do know that the word for biscotti, you know, the word does come from twice cooked biscotto, you know, and in fact, these cookies are twice cooked. What's interesting, though, is that in Italy, the word biscotto or biscotti doesn't just refer to these twice-baked cookies. It refers to all sorts of cookies,
right?
Even those that aren't twice baked. So it gets a little bit complicated. And the word that most Italians use for these twice baked biscotti are, in fact, cantucci.
Yes.
That's the word that you'll hear in Prato and other parts of Tuscany where the cookie originated.
Tell us a little bit about the range here. You have a variety of takes on... Oh, before I get that, I just opened a page, and I have to remark on your illustrations, a combination of photography and illustrations that are absolutely adorable. Here's a biscotti holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
I know. Isn't that so wonderful? So the publisher is Chronicle Books, and they do such a beautiful job with the design of their cookbooks, especially these little gifty cookbooks like Ciao Biscotti. And so their designer is just really, they hit the jackpot with this one. The little whimsical Renaissance sort of illustrations mixed with the biscotti pictures are just so wonderful and charming.
Here's one with a savory one called, that has pancetta in it, and it has a little illustration of a pig, and then the little biscotti are joined up like sausage links.
Isn't that just fabulous? I love it. Yeah. So I was just so tickled when I saw what this book was going to look like. It's really just a gem.
But back to how you talked to us about how you laid it out, which explains the content pretty well.
Yeah, so I started with biscotti basics, and there's some information and tips on making the dough, toasting nuts, skinning hazelnuts, I mean, all that basic stuff that you want to know when you bake biscotti. And then I have a classic chapter, so the basic, the almond biscotti, and biscotti made with other traditional ingredients like hazelnuts, anise, lemon, citrus. So those are the more traditional recipes for biscotti. And then I did a chapter on biscotti made with chocolate dough or biscotti that have chocolate in them, just because there's so much fun you can have with chocolate. I mean, you can drizzle your biscotti with dark chocolate, melted chocolate, or white chocolate, or milk chocolate, or combination. I have chocolate and cherries in one combination, chocolate and ginger for the holidays. There's a chapter on biscotti with fruit, and so there's one that's got toasted coconut, and it's dipped in chocolate, and it's not near tradition at all, but it's one of my favorites because the toasted coconut is a little bit crumbly and crispy, and it goes so well with the melted dark chocolate. So now we're getting into a little bit of whimsical territory, non-traditional territory.
But then you became a total renegade and went down the savory biscotti.
Yes.
I've never had one, and I'm just absolutely dying to try out the Gorgonzola one.
Well, when you do, I think you'll really appreciate these. Yeah, these are really not traditional. But I first started making savory biscotti back when I wrote my book Big Night In, which came out in 2008. And I was looking for interesting appetizers, and I don't know. It was sort of like a light bulb moment. I don't know where I got this genius little idea, but I thought, savory biscotti. So instead of the sugar, I added more salt, and instead of fruit to the nuts, I added grated cheese, and I ended up with these wonderful savory biscotti. And so I decided to include a whole chapter on savory biscotti. So I have a version that has minced pancetta, gorgonzola and walnuts that you mentioned, almond and aged Asiago, and one that I really like has smoky Gouda and a little bit of smoked paprika. So, yeah, like I said, the sky's the limit. Once you start down this path, you can find almost endless combinations to have fun with.
Well, now, what do the Tuscans think about this? Surely this is tantamount to behavior that would have you drummed out of the regiment.
I haven't asked them. I'm afraid to. No, I to say I am a purist and a traditionalist in some respects, but I feel like, oh my goodness, even if you go to Italy, things have changed so much. You can get a muffin or a bagel in Italy now, which I'm not sure I like that actually, but I do see
bagels are very expensive, however.
Yeah, and so but you know, Italian food bloggers are doing all kinds of fun things. Everybody's mixing metaphors, I suppose. And so I think that possibly even in Tuscany they might embrace some of these non-traditional versions. But in the end, what I really wanted was a book of delicious tasting cookies, and I wanted to have fun with it. I really do follow the spirit of tradition, I think, and I don't think that any of the recipes are so outlandish that they really compromise the flavor or the goodness of real biscotti. And the traditional way of serving biscotti is with a little glass of vin santo, but some of the recipes in this book really wouldn't go with vin santo, so I added beverage choices or beverage suggestions. Like, I made a batch of hazelnut biscotti last week, and I made them very large, sort of like coffee house size, and I drizzled it with both chocolate and dark chocolate, and I would never dare dip that into a glass of vin santo, but it's perfect for dunking in your morning coffee.
Yes.
Yeah, now, so biscotti is also traditionally used in the morning with your morning coffee.
Well, there are some real purists who say that they don't even do that. It's just paired with a glass of vin santo after dinner.
Okay.
But I think those are the most inflexible traditionalists.
Well, we should note that you have one in here, the Nutella sandwich cookies, and we should raise a glass and one of these in RIP, the inventor of Nutella. Did you see
yes.
that?
Oh no!
I didn't know there was a person responsible.
Well, there's always a person somewhere.
I just saw that the other day. Yes,
it made him a multimillionaire.
Yeah,
he's probably
turned Nutella into worldwide, I think, beloved ingredient.
He's probably in the same part of heaven as the people who invented Marmite and Vegemite.
No doubt. Just don't mix them together. Well, yeah, so I do have at the end of the book, I have a little chapter called Beyond Biscotti, and that's just some of my favorite Italian cookies that are not biscotti, and those Nutella sandwich cookies are in that chapter, and they're sort of like a nice little butter cookie sandwich together with Nutella, one of my favorites to make.
Well, this is a very tidy, inspired book, and I think that it would be really good for giving as a gift. So congratulations on this, Domenica, yet another feather in your cap. I read where you've written five books, but we've talked to you so many times, you must have written more than that.
I think this is book number six officially, and yeah, so number six, my first one came out in 2006, but I love this work so much. I love traveling throughout Italy, looking for inspiration and recipes. I love creating these recipes in my own kitchen and writing these books. It really just brings me so much joy. And then to see it published in such a beautiful way, the way Chronicle did with this Biscotti book, is
it's charming.
It's such a satisfying thing. Yeah.
Well, you'll have to go to Expo Milano, I guess, this year. The Italians are doing leftovers.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure I'm going to make it. I'm headed to Italy in early April, and And that's right before, I think, Expo Milan.
May 1 is when it opens. Expo, May 1, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
What part of Italy are you going to?
Well, I'm going to be going to Liguria, which I haven't spent a lot of time in.
No, we
haven't.
So
I'm really
either.
Looking forward to exploring Liguria, and then a few days in Torino, which I also haven't explored. But I cannot wait, because these are just beautiful parts of Italy, and I know I'm just going to find all kinds of inspiration there.
Enjoy yourself, and thank you for talking to us yet again, and keep us in mind for your next book.
Oh, I absolutely will. I always enjoy our conversations. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Domenica.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I just wanted to interject something here that really doesn't have anything to do with biscotti, but I guess it has to do with cookies. We were talking to a guest recently, and did you pick up on the fact that you can now get kosher Oreos?
Yes, I did.
I thought that was pretty startling.
Yeah, I meant to say something about it, but we didn't.
things catch our attention, as you probably noticed. The more obscure, the better. And what could be more obscure
than Oreos?
No, than a vodka that somehow has gold in the preparation process.
Yeah, well, this is yours. I'll let you
this
explain
is mine.
That
well,
one.
Well, it's no. You just have to listen to the interview. It's just too complicated to explain, except that our
it's a good story.
Yeah, it's a great story, and we should just have our friend explain it. There's a lot of gold on the outside of the bottle of deluxe vodka, but my question is, how much gold is there in the liquid inside? We're talking to Alex Finkelstein, who is the CEO of the company which produces deluxe vodka. And he's calling us from the United States, but he actually lives in Poland, and his distillery is in Belarus. Go figure that geographical puzzle out, if you would. how much gold is in there, Alex?
Well, actually, deluxe vodka is filtered in 24-karat gold, but there is no gold actually in the liquid itself.
Okay. So, in fact, one of the reasons you use gold, I'm guessing, is because it's pretty impervious, so it's a good to use in a part of the filtering process where you don't want anything to be left behind in the liquid itself.
Sure. The gold actually used to smoothen the taste of the vodka. It's actually a very old recipe. The deluxe vodka is produced in the Minsk, Belarus distillery, which has been open for over 100 years. So it's just a process that they use, smoothing out the taste of the vodka.
Right. Now, I mean, first I thought, do you remember there was an old-time a liqueur called Goldwasser that had flecks of gold floating around in it? Do you remember that?
Sure. My parents actually used to own liquor stores when we first moved in, to the United States. So I do remember, the Goldschlager Alcohol.
And so when did this start? When did you start producing your current vodkas?
We launched our product in August of 2014, but it was a long road to get the project launched. Countless meetings with the distillery and the head of the distillery and the team, and we tried different recipes and obviously different bottle designs. It was about maybe a two-year process just getting to the launch of the vodka.
Well, it's beautifully bottled. It just is stunning to look at.
Thank you very much. We wanted to stand out between the rest of the other bottles, especially with the vodka being such a saturated market. We wanted our bottle to stand out from the rest.
Yeah, now why choose to be in the vodka business at all? I mean, does it run in your family?
Actually, Belarus, believe it or not, is the number one drinking per capita country in the world.
Really?
So, I don't know if it runs in my family or in my blood.
I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily a title you want to lay much claim to.
Sure. But they're very proud. They're very proud of that title. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but yeah, just the Eastern European tradition. Vodka is the most traditional drink in the Eastern European culture.
Sure.
And, you know, being from Belarus and living in Eastern Europe, run into vodka all the time, different brands, and then decided to try it for ourselves. We decided that we could do it better than the competition.
So you were trying to get the smoothest, except I think it has more flavors, actually, as well as being smooth, than other vodkas.
Sure. Deluxe vodka is distilled from grain. It's a grain distilled vodka. This is when vodka was invented hundreds of years ago. The original recipe was also from grain. There are vodkas right now that are distilled from grapes.
The French are good at that, aren't they? The French
sure,
have a lot of vodkas of that kind.
Yes. But to the true vodka connoisseur, a vodka from grapes is not actually a real vodka. So we're trying to bring back a traditional recipe of vodka when it was first invented, made from the traditional ingredients.
Now, it's really funny because we were all raised being told that vodka was made from potatoes.
Sure, potatoes, that was after grain. Potatoes is also an older tradition. Lots of potato vodka comes from the Poland region, so also Eastern Europe. It's also an acceptable ingredient, but again, to get back to the grapes, that's more of a wine than a vodka.
I think I sort of tend to agree with you. I was really intrigued because there's a company in Maine, a small boutique distillery that produces gin and vodka, and you possibly don't know this if you haven't been in the United States all that much, but Maine is very famous for its potatoes.
I did not know that. For the lobster.
so they make their vodka out of potatoes because there's a surplus of potatoes in Maine. And we did hear about an interesting company in the southwest of England, which happens to be in the potato business, and mostly they use their potatoes to make potato chips. But they decided that they would be able to use the waste pieces that wouldn't sort of fit properly into the making of potato chips, so all the leftover bits they made into vodka.
Oh, that's very creative. Very creative of them.
Now, you say grain. Now, what is the actual grain that's used?
It's a wheat-based.
Okay, all right. I was thinking that because that's the native grain, I guess, of the southern parts of the Soviet Union, as we used to know it, or Russia.
Yeah, that's correct. 100% of the vodka in Belarus is produced from grain. They're very serious about their vodka and their tradition. So in Poland, you'll find different potato vodkas, wheat-based, but in Belarus, they're very strict, and so 100% of the vodka there is from grain.
Okay, now your whole portfolio is these two vodkas that we received?
Did we get two different ones?
I thought...
No, yeah. I think we got two bottles of the same one.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
The only difference was when we opened the second one, we started to run out.
Oh.
we've been tapping the well because it's really a fine vodka, and it does. There's something about the taste of it that tastes true. tastes like vodka ought to taste like.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the whole point of our mission.
Is vodka is all you make?
Yeah, we are going to be doing flavored drinks in the future. Obviously, also mixed drinks that we're going to be coming out with. But right now, we just wanted to focus on getting the brand out there and getting some awareness, some attention for our brand. And then after that, we're definitely going to move forward with different products and flavors. And
you've made it through the morass of being able to get the vodka into the United States now. What's its availability like here?
Sure. At this point, we have distribution in some of the larger markets, Texas, California, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois. And now, slowly, we're going to be getting into the smaller markets. It's definitely a grueling process, and obviously the larger companies have it much easier. The more established brands have it much easier. But slowly but surely, we're getting out there into the market. I think within the next year or so, we'll definitely be in 20 to 30% of the United States. So that would be great.
Now, on the menu is heard all around the world. So tell us about some of the markets, perhaps in Europe and in other parts of the world, where you are or you hope to be.
Sure, sure. At this point, we're in Italy, England, mostly in the London area, Germany, in the Berlin area, over 200 stores in Poland. We had a very successful deluxe vodka tour that we did with some celebrities. It was 5 different countries in 3 days, so it was a lot of fun, and We had some good marketing done, and the vodka has been selling very well, especially in Poland, in the Polish market.
What did you do before you made vodka?
Oh, that's a good question. Mostly my family's, I've just been in the family business. We've been in the meat business, in the beef industry and the leather industry in Europe for the past 10 years. We've been able to be quite successful, but it's not very much fun.
now the meat raising is taking place in Poland?
Yeah, we kosher beef.
No, I was asking for a particular reason, because we were in Italy last October. Mm-hmm. At a restaurant where we had visited before, and we had a wonderful time drinking lots and lots of wine, and we had a beef course as one of the many courses we ate, and we remember Walter
yes.
Stavolo told us that he uses beef from Poland because he thinks it's the best beef that he can buy in Europe. He prefers it to Italian beef and beef from anywhere else, and he says the Polish is the best, and that's why we serve it.
Sure, the Polish agricultural industry is very good, and all the animals are naturally fed, so it's definitely the most healthy type of beef that you can eat.
Well, if people want to find out more about Deluxe Vodka and perhaps where they might be able to obtain it, do you have a website that has that information?
Yes, we do have a website. All the information of where to purchase the vodka is through our main distributor, Mexcor. They're located in the Texas market, but they have distribution with co-distributors in over 22 states.
Now, do they have a website then that you would suggest people go to?
Sure, sure. The website is Mexcor, MEXCOR.com.
Well, we are so glad that we tracked you down. We won't explain fully just how complicated it was that connecting up with Alex. We thought we had a connection with another person, and then we started scratching around trying to find out who was out there, and Alex must be a demon on email because he called us back within 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm glad you got a hold of me. Yeah, I check my email all the time.
Yeah, so we're so glad to meet you telephonically. Perhaps, who knows, one of these days we'll meet in person, and in the meantime we're certainly enjoying this wonderful product that you make. And listeners, if you're a connoisseur of vodka, then cast aside all thoughts of buying Grey Goose, which is made from grape juice, right, Alex?
That's correct.
Why would you want to drink something like that when you can drink the real thing?
Now, do you feed this to the cows?
No.
Well, yeah, they do in Japan with the
Kobe beef.
Well, I right now I'm enjoying drinking the deluxe vodka on its own, straight out of the freezer, but I'm also making a cocktail out of it with some very special Italian sweet vermouth, which crossed our doorstep about the same time. Tastes a lot like a Negroni. So if you're looking for a new formulation for a Negroni, I just presented you with it. And we wish you the very best of luck. And I'm sure the slope probably gets not as steep since you've achieved what you've already achieved. And I'm sure you'll get there.
Thank you very much. It's
Thank
been a pleasure.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you.
So now you know if you want a touch of gold with your biscotti, all you have to do is dip it in deluxe vodka. What a surprising and fascinating story. And just the way to finish out a program for another week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, next Sunday. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.